dare you? No one dared. The lieutenant turned back to Daria. Though anger had surged in her voice, her breathing was still calm and slow, and Daria guessed her heartbeat had hardly risen at all. So what's your intention? She asked. Tension sang in the air, but Daria kept her composure. I have 5 naval ships and their crews with me, she said, as well as 1,000 banished Bajuman returned to fight. I see plenty of differences among your troops. Dark skins and light, soldiers from Qandis and the Ring, and even a few with ancestors from beyond. But these aren't differences that matter, because we're all the same in wanting freedom, and a ruler who respects their position rather than misusing it. Queen Fila's mother went mad, and it seems to have infected the daughter as well. Qandis is in turmoil. We've come not to extinguish the sparks of rebellion against Fila, but to feed the flames. The lieutenant's mischievous eyes gleamed as she grinned at Daria. Hells, Admiral. Why didn't you just say so? Then the lieutenant turned to her garrison, a few of them grumbling, but most of them mumbling and nodding their heads in agreement. Martin, she shouted at the pot-bellied sergeant. Yes, lieutenant. Raise the boom. With Mirren's hand in his, Deimos could almost believe that anything might be a good idea. When she kissed him and he inhaled her scent, when he tangled his fingers in her hair, he felt courage and hope flood into his heart. He stood taller, and the bruises and aches from his enslavement diminished. But even blinded by her confidence, he still thought she might be about to get all 3 of them killed. They'd spent most of the night in a grist mill at the base of Palace Hill, just on the other side of Scholar's Bridge from the tavern where Deimos had stabbed a member of the city guard in the throat. Every fiber of his being screamed to flee the city, to get into the river somehow and keep floating till he reached Suskmith. In his current state, a branded slave and a fugitive, Admiral Halardi would never take him back into the fleet. But he knew that the pirate captains were always hiring, and half of them bore brands themselves. That was a joke now, a very small one that he made with himself. Though as a boy he'd dreamed of being a pirate, the reality seemed more like a nightmare. Mirren had told him about his mother's death, ailing since his father's execution and Cyrus's death. Though comfortable with Clan Docklin, she had simply faded away. Grief had taken her. For Deimos, the news had not come as a shock, because in truth he had been expecting it every day. But he'd cried in Mirren's arms nevertheless. So much taken from him. So many people he loved. At least now he was trying to make amends. My love, Deimos said as gently as possible. This seems like a terrible idea. Mirren tugged his hand and they kept walking. Outside the walls of the palace itself, Palace Hill teemed with life. Courtiers and rich merchants who were not members of one of the 5 great clans had built up the hill with grandly designed homes that were stacked, sometimes literally, on top of one another. Nobles from foreign lands lived in the shadow of the palace, there to keep good relations with the crown of Qandis and to negotiate trade agreements. Among the homes and inns were a multitude of shops of all sorts, from dressmakers and milliners to jewelers and bakers. Mirren and Deimos walked hand in hand, her in the sort of veil sometimes worn by maidens from religious families, and him in the hooded robe of a Colberite diplomat, stolen from the man's carriage as his driver helped him inside after some morning jaunt or another. Tolliver had promised to meet them at their destination. How he intended to make his way up Palace Hill unnoticed, Deimos didn't know. Once it would have been a simple task for a Bajuman child to move unseen, but now his presence would shock any who spotted him. In weeks, the world had changed. At the Temple of 4, he'd have been safe, but anywhere else in the city, he'd be killed by the first city guard he encountered. The day had turned cloudy, the temperature falling as the morning progressed. In a narrow street near the top of the hill, they passed a tailor's shop and the studio of a portrait artist whose mother had once painted a portrait of the late Queen Lysandra's father, King Baejin. Or so said the sign in the studio's window. A few steps past the artist's studio, near the end of the quaint little street, Deimos paused and turned to her. "You can't keep ignoring me." Mirren tucked a lock of hair behind her ear. He could make out the shape of her face behind the sky blue lace veil. "I love you," she said, "but you've got to trust me. This is the only way." He moved closer to her. "We should be fleeing," he whispered. "We can't. Why not?" Mirren squeezed his hands in hers, fixed her gaze on him. "My sister is ruining this city. The rest of the nation will follow. She must be stopped."
"By us?"
"I don't know the answer to that. Not yet. I know I was the first to suggest we flee together, but if there's any chance of us getting out of Lartha alive and together, we've got to buy ourselves time. That means you standing in front of the queen and telling her what you've learned. I don't trust her word, but I trust her fury. We need that fury directed elsewhere." Deimos sighed.
"I see the logic, though I'm afraid she's no longer the sort who follows any rational logic."
Mirren did not bother to lift her veil before she kissed him. The lace kept their lips from touching, but the rough scrape of the fabric made him shiver. It had been far too long since he'd traced the lines of her body with his hands. Queen Fila might have him executed eventually, but in that moment he prayed to An-Salam that he would make love to Mirren one more time before he died. Carriage wheels clattered and a horse chuffed behind them, and the two of them shifted out of its path. Deimos turned his back to it, hoping it wasn't the Kalbarite diplomat's carriage. That would be just his luck, being stopped because of his stolen robe instead of his noble name or the murder of a guardsman. But the carriage rolled on. Deimos grinned at Mirren, and they fell in behind it, marching in its wake as if part of some entourage. The carriage rattled along to the end of the road, and then headed downhill. Deimos and Mirren turned uphill, and now there was no more hiding. A sprinkle of rain began to fall, and the chilly wind whipped along the much broader road. The small guardhouse beside the palace gate contained one guardsman. Four other guards were visible, though two of them were focused on the ragtag camp of the queen's subjects, who always seemed to be clustered to the left of the gates. Dozens of the queen's subjects who had come to make some entreaty or other, to beg her help or forgiveness. "Which is precisely what I'm here to do," Deimos thought. A child in a jacket comically large on him darted from the gathered citizens. He wore a fisherman's cap pulled down over his face, hiding his hair entirely. As the rain picked up and the boy rushed toward them, Deimos realized this was Tolliver. He grinned, though he was not at all surprised that the sneaky little bastard had made it all the way to the gate undiscovered. A rugged-faced guardsman in a faded uniform came forward to challenge them, not yet reaching for his sword but very evidently willing. Deimos used his left hand to cover the brand on his right.
"Get in line with the others,"
he snapped, gesturing toward the huddled group. Mirren removed her veil, letting it dangle from her fingers down at her side. "Open the gates, Sergeant." She never stopped moving, striding right up to the seasoned guardsmen. The two who were overseeing the supplicants paid no attention, but the woman came out of the guardhouse, and she and the others took positions in front of the gate, hands very clearly on the pommels of their swords.
Swords. Fuck. Deimos had forgotten all about the guardsman's sword dangling in its scabbard from the belt around his waist.
He felt his face flush but kept his head tilted downward, hiding as best he could beneath his stolen hood.
"Princess Mirren?" the aging guardsman said.
"I'm glad you recognize me. It will make this moment much easier. Open the gates."
"For you, of course," he replied.
But you know better than anyone what the Queen's law states regarding entry into the palace. Too much to hope, Deimos thought. It was always going to come to this.
He threw back his hood and drew aside the cloak to reveal the sword at his side. The guardsman swore and drew his own blade.
Callistrate, the man snarled, full of hatred, but no surprise.
And why should they be surprised, when by now the whole city must know of his escape from the Apex's home?
Deimos calmly raised his hands. Sergeant, I don't think either of us wants to die today, but I promise you that if you come anywhere near me or the princess, you'll lose your head. I'm not confident I can kill 5 of you, but I know you'll die first.
He gestured to the larger of the 2 guards by the gates. Then him. Probably at least 1 more. I suppose it'll be up to the rest of you which one.
Quiet, you fool, Mirren snapped at him.
Deimos frowned at her, telling himself she'd meant it lovingly.
I haven't even drawn my sword.
The other 2 by the gates had drawn theirs, though, and the 2 watching over the gathered citizens had finally noticed the trouble and were making their way over.
Mirren reached out for Tolliver and pulled the boy to her. She ripped off his hat to reveal his blonde hair and those winter eyes.
What are you doing, princess?
The sergeant asked, unsure now, almost mystified.
Returning home with my fiancé and a new friend.
A Bodgeman child,
one of the guards muttered.
What do we?
The sergeant seemed to realize that with his sword held a certain way, it might seem as if he meant to harm the princess. Uncertainty etched his brow.
Deimos Callistrate is an escaped slave, wanted for murdering the Praegis of the House of Apex Euphraxia. There was another murder last night in a downhill tavern, the sergeant said. There's a witness who described the killer.
We believe
your fiancé is the man,
and that sword at his hip tells enough of the story that I'm convinced.
Mirren gave Tolliver a little shove. The boy stumbled against Deimos, who had to catch him.
Weaponless, Mirren approached the guardsman, her greater height forcing him to look up at her.
I've seen you at this gate 1,000 times, Sergeant, but I don't know your name.
Off balance, eyes shifting to glance at Deimos, the sergeant steadied his grip on his sword.
Rokai, princess.
Sergeant Rokai. I want to be very clear.
She glanced past him at the other guardsmen. Many supplicants had stood and shuffled closer, but not so close that a sword might find them if a fight broke out.
I am the daughter of Lysandra, the granddaughter of Bejin, the sister of Queen Phila, who is waiting to hear the words my fiancé, Deimos Callistrate, is prepared to speak. The Queen is head of the faith now, so the Apex will have to take up the question of Deimos's supposed enslavement with her. Whatever crimes you may accuse him of, it is up to the Queen to determine his guilt or innocence. Is it not?
Frustrated, the sergeant glanced at the ground, as if the answer might await him between the cobblestones.
She's got you there, Deimos said. Tolliver elbowed him in the gut. Deimos huffed, but said nothing more.
Is it not? Mirren repeated.
It is,
the sergeant allowed.
Then we will let her decide, after she's heard what he has to say.
Sergeant Rokai shook his head. Princess, I'm sorry, I cannot.
Mirren reached back, lightning quick, and drew the sword from the scabbard at Deimos's side. He tried to reach for her, but she turned on the astonished sergeant. He tried to defend himself, but Mirren was too swift. She twisted, easily parried, and plunged the sword into the side of his neck, where his armor could not protect him.
Godsmere, what are you doing?
Deimos shouted, his words lost in the cries of the waiting people and guardsmen.
We're going to die, Tolliver whispered.
Mirren did not take so much as a backward step. Instead, she brandished the bloody sword toward the other guardsmen as their sergeant lay dying on the ground.
Sergeant Rokai disobeyed a direct command from a princess of the crown, she said.
I am Mirren of Quandis. The blood of the Four runs in my veins. This man and this boy are under my protection. I tell you now and for the last time to open that fucking door.
They opened the door.
Chapter 16.
As both Queen of Quandis and Head of the Faith, Vila could never betray any doubts about what she was doing, nor any sense of weakness or uncertainty. The Faith had split in two almost immediately upon her proclamation that the crown now ruled over the priesthood. Word had traveled quickly down into the ranks, from High Order member to ordinary priest to novice, from Temple of Four to Yaris Teague. Perstellan had been her greatest source of information about the war of loyalty tearing the priesthood apart. The one-eyed woman came from the ring. She'd spent time with pirates and penters and atheists and kept her faith firm. Perstellan believed in Fila's claim that the blood of the Four ran in her veins and gave her dominion over the Temple of Four. She agreed with Fila's aims to use magic to make the land truly great once more, forging peace with foreign lands, forcing trade agreements, expanding their influence, all with the heavy threat of magic underpinning everything that Queen Fila did or said. So the Queen knew that factions had formed, friends had become enemies, and which of the High Order priests were with her and against her. Strife and chaos had erupted, but Fila cared nothing for such disruptions. If anything, she welcomed them as she worked to consolidate her own powers. She was firm in her actions and aims, focused in her aspirations and where they would take her. In the end, Quandis would be the better for it. Her doubts and uncertainties were only dreams, yet they were dreams that she could feel and hear, taste and smell, and she knew that if she were to address them with the Apex, or Per Ristolo, or even Daphna the Voice, they would tell her things she did not wish to know. If she ventured down to the Wall of the Four, that buried place she had visited many times, but which she had studied far less than she should have, she would find answers to the doubts presenting themselves to her now, in sleep, in dreams. In her dreams, Lartha had been laid waste, its seven great hills cracked by violent upheavals, buildings fallen or burned to the ground. The blood spire was shattered halfway up, its upper section crumbled to nothing and scattered around Palace Hill like shards of frozen blood. The scent of decay hung over the once great city, as if its whole population had huddled in their basements and died. A terrific wind swept in from the north, and slowly, slowly settled a film of glimmering ice across the ruins, hiding her city from view. Perhaps after the wind would come snow, burying the sad remains beneath an eon-long winter. Water washed through the city's lower extremes, carrying with it the detritus of a dying land. Upturned boats, bloated cattle corpses, splintered timbers from shattered buildings, uprooted trees, all mixed into a sad stew. In the city, behind the shadows and beneath the places where the dead rotted into history, shades of things unknown and unknowable stirred, promising a revelation of utter horror. It was always then that Fila woke, sweating and cursing, grasping on to the new day and clinging on for dear life. Five times she had suffered these nightmares, each time during sleep following a descent to the tombs. She mentioned them to no one. She kept them to herself because she was Queen of Quandis and Head of the Faith, the strongest and most important person in the land. And soon she would have access to the full magic of the Four, and she would become the Eternal Queen. The dreams were merely a way for her mind to expand and comprehend the enormity of what was happening to her. They were what she could do to this world, should she wish it so. She would never wish that upon Lartha and Quandis. Everything she did was for the good of the land and its people, and she knew that her mother would be proud.
You look tired, Majesty.
Her sister's voice startled Fila from her thoughts. She snapped up a wine glass and took a long swig, covering her expression and allowing herself time to gather her senses. Sparks of light danced in her vision. She heard the breath of mice, the sound of a gull's wing somewhere over the city, and she smelled street food from a mile away, and the closer, more animal stink of betrayal.
Calistrate, she said, before turning around and laying eyes upon Deimos Calistrate and her sister Mirren.
Are you sure you're not sick?
Mirren asked.
Sick?
Fila asked.
I've never been better.
She looked them up and down. Deimos had dried blood beneath his fingernails and a spatter across his cheek. She'd expected the slave's brand on his hand, but the sight of it was still startling somehow, a stain on all nobility, not merely his own. He wore a Colbarite's robe, evidently stolen, and a sword hung from his belt. The blood on Mirren's hand was fresher.
That's not your blood, Queen Fila said, nodding at Mirren's hand. It's a commoner's.
Are we alone? Mirren asked, ignoring Fila's comment.
That annoyed Fila for a beat, but then she shrugged the annoyance aside. Mirren could act familiar for a little while longer.
Alone, Queen Fila confirmed. But I must ask, how did the two of you get here?
Mirren looked around the room as if she had never seen it before. Fila saw something different in her sister's eyes, a weight of some new experience, a strength that carried a hint of sadness alongside. She took in the paintings and sculptures hung and placed around the chamber. It was a place of history that kings and queens traditionally used for private contemplation and introspection, watched over by ancestors, afforded wisdom by likenesses of some of the great men and women from Qantas's long history. Fila had taken to coming here once each day in the certain knowledge that she was adding a huge new chapter to the land's story, and the people staring at her with painted or stony eyes would be proud of what she was about to achieve. Or if not proud, then at least respectful.
Your guards are easy to blind with a royal's needs, Mirren said, staring at Fila at last. You do look different.
I am, Fila said. I'm ruling Qantas as it always should have been ruled.
And how is that? Deimos asked.
Queen Fila looked him up and down and ignored his question.
He's come with news, Mirren said. He's fulfilled the task you set him, listened for news from the House of the Apex.
Good, Fila said. It seems, however, that you don't require my intervention to afford your release.
I had to escape, Deimos said. I heard too much.
Too much of what?
He shifted his weight from foot to foot as if nervous. She could sense worry coming off him in waves, and wondered what he had been through in the House of Euphraxia.
If I tell you, you'll keep your bargain, free me and allow—
You dare bargain with the Queen?
Fila asked. Her voice was loud, edged with a magical power that she felt surging through her system, sparkling in her brain, sharpening her senses. She heard a heavy rattle and the soft hush of falling grit as ancient sculptures vibrated and shook on their pedestals. Deimos took a step back, eyes wide. To her credit, Mirren did not, but Fila saw the fear growing in her sister's eyes.
And what do they see in mine? She wondered.
Majesty, Deimos said, lowering his head. I would not dream of bargaining.
But the arrangement stands, Mirren said. He spies for you. You let him free.
He seems to be free already.
You know what I mean, sister. Deimos and I could never have any sense of liberty in and around Lartha unless he is pronounced a free man.
Queen Fila shrugged. This was becoming tiresome, and she needed to hear what Deimos had to say. She had the feeling, the certainty, that it would impact current events.
She already believed Euphraxia to be preparing to stand against her.
This might be confirmation. Tell me what you heard, she said.
Majesty, I heard the Apex plotting and planning against you with a priest of the High Order,
Deimos said. Phila's heart darkened.
Which priest?
I don't know her, but I heard Euphraxia use her name. Pergerin.
Anger flared in the queen's breast. Pergerin, who'd presented herself as so loyal alongside Per Ristolo and Per Stellan, who knew what would become of herself and her brother and his family and others of their blood. The bitch had betrayed her queen. So Per Stellan didn't know everything. She'd come from the ring, of course, so she couldn't have been expected to. But still, it rankled Phila. As Deimos continued relaying what he had overheard, she felt her rage growing, and the fire of magic burning deep within her belly. By the time he had finished, she was ready to catch a flame. She shivered, fury singing through her muscles and bones. She felt a power deep within her. But Phila was sensible enough to rein that power in. She nursed it, soothing it with inner murmurs like a mother singing her child down from tears to sleep. She didn't need it yet, and it would be best wait until it was fully formed, readily absorbed before revealing its full presence. Besides, she was queen. There were powers other than magic at her disposal.
Shom, she said,
and the silence slipped from the shadows at the corner of the room. Phila heard Mirin's and Deimos's soft gasps of surprise as the tall warrior drifted to Phila's side.
Go and fetch Commander Curtness and Daphna to me, Phila said, and raise your warriors, all of them. We'll be careful and canny, but the Silent are going to war, and the city guard with you.
Struggling to keep her voice modulated and even, Phila closed her eyes.
The Temple of Four will fall, and anyone there who plots against me will pay for their treachery. And you?
She opened her eyes again and pointed at Deimos. You were once a warrior for Quandis, and you will be again. You'll lead a platoon of the city guard in the initial attack and bring me Euphraxia's head.
The Apex.
That's the price of your freedom, Deimos Callistrate, Phila said. The head of the bitch who goes against me. Now leave, all of you.
Shom moved quickly from the room, but Mirin and Deimos remained.
Sister, this surely can't be the way.
Go!
Phila shouted. Across the room, the bust of a forgotten Quandian cracked in two and fell to the floor. A painting nearby burst into flame. Shadows seethed and settled again, and stars bloomed and faded all across the room. Breathing heavily, Queen Phila watched as Mirin and her lover hurried from the room, confused and scared, and left her alone. Alone but for the magic that roared within her.
And it will roar even louder, she thought. All of it. The time for caution and care has passed, and every shred of magic must now be mine.
While the Silent and her forces attacked the Temple of Four and put down the simmering insurrection, she would follow the more treacherous path to the subterranean tombs from beneath Palace Hill. She had gone that way before but been turned back by impassable tunnels and uncrossable voids. Now, though, she knew she had the power to pass and cross. War above would allow her to fulfill her ambitions below. In a way, Euphraxia's betrayal would feed her queen's success.
Pergerin, she said.
She would instruct the woman to prepare the ritual to channel all of the magic into her.
Pergerin!
Louder. And then she began to scream for the traitorous high priest. Blaine tried to appear normal when nothing in his life would ever be normal again. His conversation with Apex Euphraxia colored every thought, every move he made,
and every decision he was destined to take. And deep down inside, empowering his mind and swelling his heart, was the magic he had touched and used. He was not the man he used to be, yet for now he had to keep up appearances. It was wash day among the novices. Blaine no longer felt like a novice, yet Yaris Teague was now the place where he felt most at home. The washroom was large and humid, and most of the novice priests had stripped down to their undergarments as they worked. Usually this would mean nothing for any of them. Their vows were strict, their dedication to the priesthood solid. Today, things were different. While Blaine scrubbed bedding, Jemmy hung wet clothing on a long line across the room. He knew that she knew he was watching. Her vest clung to her breasts, loose undershorts molding to her body as she stretched. She kept glancing at him, a curious look on her face. She did not dare speak. Blaine tried many times to look away. His own growing interest was becoming difficult to conceal, and Per Santiger would punish him severely for such a transgression. He returned Jemmy's smile, but not in a suggestive way. With everything that had happened to him over the past days, he found it ironic that it was a woman possessing his thoughts.
"Something is different about you,"
she whispered as she carried a pile of dirty robes past him. Blaine picked up some clothing and followed her toward the bank of washing baths set against the wall. He glanced around, but no one seemed to have noticed their brief exchange. Per Santiger was there, but he appeared distracted, standing at the door and looking out into Yaris Teague's courtyard.
"Don't you feel different, too?"
he asked Jemmy. He felt a rush of guilt at diverting the fact of his change onto their brief, lustful liaison. She smiled, glanced away. He saw a flush on her cheeks. Not coyness. Excitement, perhaps. Yet again, he had to concentrate to avoid his own interest rising. "I'm in turmoil," he thought. But in some ways, his life and direction had never been so clear. He could allow himself this pleasure, at least.
"A little,"
she said.
"Only in a good way."
Nothing could come of their dalliance. She had made it explicit to him that there had been no romance in her intent. Even if they had feelings for each other that extended beyond friendship, they were priests, sworn to the faith. They would one day pledge themselves to one tower or another. They'd made vows. Then again, Euphraxia had broken many vows, and she was the apex. And Blaine's plans for the future did not include remaining faithful to the Four. What would Jemmy think when he flexed the new power he had begun to acquire? When he had mastered the magic he siphoned from the tombs of the Four and used it to free the Bajuman? What difference would their vows make then? The question made him study her a little longer, made him think of her a bit differently. There were possibilities he had never before considered, and he wished to ponder them. Blaine worked the washing down into the warm, soapy water. And with every push from his hands, he remembered that curtain of water rising up and flushing across the phage when he'd encountered the apex. He could also hear Jemmy's breathing close beside him, and he had flash memories of their lovemaking, her grinding down on him as he thrust up, forbidden Congress that had felt so right. His ponderings of the future became a revelry in the past.
"I see you want to feel different again,"
Jemmy said, glancing down at his evident interest. She stared at him, serious now, and whispered,
"I'm ready."
"Jemmy,
in the drawing room, behind the blanket pile."
"Blaine?" Per Santiger was looking across the steamy room at him. The old man seemed alert and anxious, and Blaine knew immediately that this was not to do with him and Jemmy. This was nothing so trivial.
"Has Euphraxia changed her mind?"
he wondered.
"Does she want me dead after all?"
Blaine gathered himself, drawing in all he had learned of magic, and felt his strength growing. Perhaps here, in this wet place, he could call on Daphine once more.
"Blaine!"
Per Santiger called again.
"A messenger for you."
The old priest kept glancing out into the courtyard where Blaine could not see.
Messenger?
Jemmy's eyebrows raised. Novices were never contacted by their families and friends outside, even less so if they were Bajuman. Blaine shrugged, unsure himself, and walked past Jemmy. He crossed the big washroom, the other novices watching him go, silent and curious. Persantiger left the room as he approached, and exiting into the coolness of the courtyard beyond, Blaine saw a man standing inside the gates. They had been closed behind him, as they had each day since the city guards had come for the Bajuman priests. Another change in the order of things that now seemed normal. The man was breathing hard, coated in a skein of sweat. He wore the uniform of a sailor of the Kwandian Navy.
"He says he's here for you, and you alone,"
Persantiger said, clearly not happy with any of this.
"My name's Thistle, from the naval ship Royal Dawn, under command of Admiral Hilardi,"
Thistle said, still catching his breath.
"I've run from Suskmith, with a message for the novice priest Blaine."
"I'm Blaine."
"Then this message is yours, direct from the Admiral herself."
He walked across the courtyard and held out a bamboo tube the length of his forearm, a traditional scroll holder used on Navy ships to keep paper dry.
"Admiral?"
Blaine asked. He was confused. He looked to Persantiger, but the old priest merely shrugged, seeming angry at the intrusion rather than curious.
"Take it, then," Persantiger said. "The poor man's run 30 miles to drop it in your hand."
"I don't understand," Blaine said.
"And you never will unless you read the god's damned thing."
Blaine was shocked by the priest's swearing, as was Thistle. But he knew very well what distracted Persantiger. He must have got wind of the queen, the tombs, her lust for magic, and her murder of Per Ostvik. The faith was tearing itself apart. The old man was witnessing change before his eyes. And now something else strange had happened. Blaine could not help thinking that this mysterious message must be connected in some way to that change. He took the bamboo tube, nodding his thanks. He could see no distaste in Thistle's expression in handing such a message to a Bajuman. Blaine turned and walked to the far side of the courtyard. He expected the priest to call him back, but he was given his privacy. And when he glanced back, he saw Persantiger guiding the sailor to the mess building where he could find food and drink. Beyond, crowded in the washroom doorway, half a dozen pale faces watched him, Jemmy among them. Blaine cracked the wax seal and pulled the tied scroll of paper from the bamboo tube. It was only one sheet, the message short. From the very first words, Blaine's world lurched and changed more than it ever had before. "Blaine, my dear brother, it's time to tell you the truth of my fate, my non-death, my survival, and the life I have led since that fall from the cliff. There is so much to tell, but for now I have so little time, so I must keep this message brief. I was picked up by pirates, and then saved by the Kwandian Navy. They believed me the last surviving Hilardi from a pirate raid on Tan Kushir, and took me into their care. The sea bleached my eyes, sharp rocks scoured my Bajuman brand, and I became a sailor in the Navy. From there, over the years and through many promotions, I am now admiral of my own fleet, a fearsome naval warrior. Who would have thought it, brother? You might not believe me, and so, mother sang as she dressed you in the morning, while I dressed myself. Older than you, I was able to do so. You liked the stale knobs of bread from street vendors. I liked apple cores. Mother liked neither, but we thought that was only so that we could both eat. Mother called you her little puppy, while I was her kitten. I hope you believe me. I hope you can forgive me. I have been following your life and making sure you are well, though from a distance that is difficult. I'm glad you chose the priesthood. I think I would have done the same if fate hadn't cast me down a different path. A time of conflict is coming, Blaine, and that's why I've chosen to contact you now. I will be in Lartha soon. Perhaps amid the inevitable turmoil we can meet. I dream of it. Your loving sister, Daria. Blaine's whole world turned, spun, blurred, and pulsed around him, its center. He had never felt the focus of anything, but now he saw himself as the core about which everything else orbited. The novices, the tombs of the four, Queen Fila and her deceptions and murderous ambitions, Per Ristolo and the high priests, and now his dead sister, living again. He was the center. But everyone and everything around him told lies. He stumbled to the tall courtyard wall and sat on the edge of a well, leaning against a timber upright before dizziness spilled him to the ground. Daria was alive, no longer the living sister in his memory or the dead girl floating in the endless, cruel ocean of his imagination. She claimed now to be an admiral in the Quandian fleet. An admiral? He looked across the courtyard to where Fissel had disappeared into the dining building. He had so many questions for that messenger, yet none that he could ask in front of Per Santiger. Would the old priest let him quiz the sailor on his own? He doubted it. Influences from outside were kept to a strict minimum for the novices, because it was the four within that they sought. Blaine squeezed his eyes shut, and for just a moment he wished himself back to before he had joined the priesthood, when his mother had still been among the living. Things had been simple then. He'd been a Bajamin slave and nothing more. But now Daria was back, and nothing would ever be simple again. He had been a Bajamin before, and despite the protestations and teachings of the priesthood, he still was, heart and soul. That was the whole reason for his being here. His plans were succeeding beyond his wildest dreams. Soon he would have the power he had always dreamed of, and the ability to free every Bajamin from the slavery they had been subject to for generations. But that didn't include Daria. Daria had not been Bajamin since the day she had died. To Blaine, that was a betrayal. She had denied her heritage to take the easier path. She fought for Quandis, the oppressors of all Bajamin. She had forgotten her family. Daria, you left me alone all this time, he thought. And even though it was a selfish idea, he could not think anything else. She had escaped her heritage, left it behind, and forged a life for herself beyond him. Queen Fila had been through these tunnels before, but those were vastly different times. She was only Fila then, a young woman with ambitions, not the queen, and certainly not a woman bristling with newly acquired magic. She had felt her way through the darkness, alone, scared but excited. Now she had Per Stellan, Per Garin, and Per Ristolo with her, as well as her faithful Shome, and the diminutive Helene to guard her way. Back then, she'd had no idea what she was doing, but now she had a very definite aim in mind. There was no more need of whispering. Fila was ready to shout. As soon as they'd entered the first of the tunnels beneath Palace Hill, Per Garin had fallen silent. She'd been there when Per Ostvik died. She knew how determined and merciless Fila was, and yet she had betrayed her queen. Bold as this had been, what astonished Fila the most was that Per Garin had been courageous, or idiotic enough, to continue to pretend to be loyal. Once she had chosen to side with Euphraxia, she ought to have gathered up her brother and the rest of her family and fled the city. Fled the main island, fled beyond the outer ring to somewhere so far that she could never be found. Yet here she was, still pretending to follow her queen. Per Stellan said nothing, keenly observant, even lacking an eye. She knew when to be quiet and just watch. Queen Fila could sense that Per Stellan knew something was amiss in their small band, but the other priests didn't seem to notice at all. Per Garin had seemed unsettled. Abruptly, she dared to give voice to her unease. I must beseech you, Majesty,
You've been beseeching me for the past hour, Phyla said. And yet I don't feel I've communicated the enormity of what you're asking us to do.
I'm not asking you, Per Garen.
Magic wielded clumsily can cause great cataclysms, Per Garen said, seemingly unaware of the treacherous ground she was on. The Covenant of the Four is quite plain about that, and the evidence is available for all to see. There have been...
Yes, I know, I know. Earthquakes that Charin sent to cleave Docklin Hill in two. Daphine's flood of floods.
I've told her all this, Per Ristolo muttered as he walked.
Perstellan paused to face the other two priests.
There are larger considerations, she said gravely.
Per Garen ignored them both, forging ahead.
You've been told, Majesty, and yet you don't quite understand.
I understand everything, Queen Phyla said. Her raised voice echoed around the chamber they had stepped into. It was a rough cavern, naturally formed but with evidence of human hand in the tunnels that led off from it.
I understand your fear over magic you can't really control, but I carry the blood of the Four, and I will control it. I understand your cowardice in facing the remnants of gods you claim to worship, yet I face them, down there in the cavern of tombs, and they bless me each and every day.
Per Garen glared at her with unshielded contempt.
What I don't understand, Phyla went on, is your betrayal. After my demonstration with Per Ostvik, the idea that you'd run to Euphraxia with your tail between your legs like some shivering cur, eager for her master's love.
Even in the strange light of the caverns, Phyla could see Per Garen turn pale.
Per Garen, you didn't, Per Ristolo whispered.
The woman had been his student once, and the corners of his eyes crinkled with grief at this revelation. Perstellan wisely took a step backward, away from her fellow priests.
You fool.
Shome,
Phyla said. The Silent moved by her side, one hand on the great curved sword at her belt, the other still holding the flaming torch that lit their way. Per Garen barely had time to utter a plea for mercy before Shome impaled her with her sword, and Helaine slit her throat. A moment later, the two of them stepped away and Per Garen's body toppled wetly to the stone floor. Queen Phyla saw Per Ristolo's tears and Per Stellan's grim acceptance. The priests knelt to say a prayer by the corpse. Phyla wanted to tell them to back away, to leave the dead woman unblessed. But she found she cared very little what they did now, as long as they did it quickly.
Come along, she said.
Per Ristolo stood, and he looked stronger than before, stronger than she had ever seen him, as if new purpose had been born within him.
There is more to the Covenant than anyone alive knows, he said.
He nodded toward the narrow passageway leading from the cavern.
I know some of what lies on that route to the tombs, and I suspect you do too, but no one knows all of it. If you'd spent enough time at the Wall of the Four, like every priest training to be part of the High Order does for at least 2 years of their lives, you'd understand that much of the Covenant that is missing is likely more important than that which still exists.
How can you know that? Phyla asked. All of you in the High Order are tainted by foolishness.
Perstellan bent her head respectfully.
Per Ristolo is correct, my queen. The missing wall panels tell a story. No one knows the true end of the first city and its people. But there are hints throughout Quandis. It's a story of pain and threat, and a deep dark power that existed before the Four, before the first people. You've heard legends of the gods unnumbered.
I've spent my life in the archives of the Crown. I've read 1,000 tales of those ancient things. And every one of them is little more than an allusion to something in the shadows. The gods unnumbered are stories to frighten children,
to keep them out of sewers and away from dark alleys.
Yet there are so many, aren't there?
That's a lot of writing dedicated to just scaring children, Per Stellan said. What's your point?
The faith has never been so certain, Per Ristolo said. The gods, unnumbered, may have walked our world at the dawn of time, just as the legends say. Before Quandis, and before the First City, they may still exist.
Exist where? Phila asked. Per Ristolo shrugged.
Far away, perhaps? Across the oceans, on frozen islands or lands of fire and lava. Or maybe deeper, way down deep, past those things you believe are here to protect access to the tombs. I had a teacher once, more than a century ago, who believed that the deep things are not there to keep those above from coming below, but to keep those even farther below from coming above.
They stood silently for a moment, the only sound the steady spitting and hissing of Shom's blazing torch. Then Phila coughed a loud, hard laugh, leaning back and guffawing at the cavern ceiling. Many legged shapes scuttled out of sight, startled by the sound. Echoes twisted away through tunnels they would soon be traveling.
Trust you priests to make up such stories, she said.
She shook her head.
You really are fools, all of you. So obsessed with your religion that you failed to see what's right in front of you. You failed to see the four. But they're down there. The gods unnumbered may haunt your dreams, but the magic of the four is real and vibrant, still ablaze with power. I've been close. I've felt them. And soon I'll see them. I don't need stupid nighttime stories to scare me from my own destiny, Per Ristolo. So lead the way. My time for caution, for kowtowing to your fears and superstitions, is over. My final ritual awaits. And next time I walk into the sunlight, I'll be the greatest queen there's ever been. The Eternal Queen.
Majesty, he said, glancing down at the pool of blood spreading from beneath Per Garin's corpse. I dare not defy you, but please be certain. You risk us all. You risk Quandis if you cannot contain the power.
I risk nothing. I will be eternal, she said again.
I promise you, Per Ristolo. And you, Per Stellan, all will be well. I will raise you up. The High Order will begin anew with the two of you at its head.
And it's you we'll be praying to, Per Stellan said, gazing at her with that one eye, the other a black pit of scars and shadows. It may work, Majesty, and I will stay with you and do all I can to aid you in this. But do not forget the last time a sorcerer tried to become the fifth.
Queen Phila felt a sickness in her gut. This reminder felt like a reprimand, words spoken warily but with the impact of a slap to the face.
You dare compare me to the pent angel?
Phila whispered.
I express a concern,
the priest replied.
You cannot deny the comparison is apt for the moment. Only time and your own self-control will reveal if it remains so.
Shom and Helaine shifted toward Per Stellan without being asked, eyeing her with deadly expectation. The priest saw them but did not seem frightened or even uneasy. Queen Phila waved the silent assassins away.
One thing I will say for you, woman, Phila said. I will never doubt that you mean what you say.
Per Stellan inclined her head respectfully. Phila glanced at Per Ristolo to see if he'd dare to voice any further hesitations. Something crossed his face, but the thoughts remained unspoken. Phila let him wallow in those thoughts, and the priest turned and headed into the narrow tunnel. She followed, with Per Stellan and the two silent behind them.
They left Per Garen's corpse cooling in the cavern, blood pooling. Perhaps the ghast spiders would eat her, or perhaps something worse. The gods unnumbered, she thought, smiling in the darkness. Such foolishness. They followed a twisting route that descended deep beneath Palace Hill, and then started rising again as it ventured beneath Temple Hill. She remembered this way, though when she had come before she'd carried a small oil lamp, and the way had not been so well lit. This time she could see more detail in the tunnel walls, evidence of old tool marks and carvings in forgotten languages. If either of the high priests knew what these words said, neither of them betrayed their knowledge. Shom had moved in front of Per Rostolo, and now led the group. The other Silent brought up the rear. As they approached the huge underground chamber, even Shom slowed down and glanced back at her queen.
Let me, Phila said. I've been here before, but I'm better prepared this time.
The darkness ahead of them was thick, the sense of space intimidating, and even the two torches combined could only light a small expanse. Four natural stone bridges headed away from their side of the cavern, spanning a dizzyingly deep ravine. The vastness was staggering, but it was the feeling of something within that darkness that set even Fila's nerves jangling. Last time here she had been alone, but she had not known what to expect. Now she remembered. From far, far below, she heard the gentle splash of something breaking the surface of an underground lake. This one, she said, choosing one of the four bridges. It was the one with old rusted rings hammered into the stone, rotted ropes spanning between some of them. The way she had come before.
Dakur is there, Per Rostolo said. We can't cross. Dakur is there.
Dakur, the beast of the lake? Phila asked.
She fisted her hand, then opened it, and a mist of water condensed from the air and wetted her skin.
Hear that? Per Stellan said.
Per Rostolo is right.
Neither of you is right, Phila said,
and she walked out onto the bridge. Her heart hammered, but she breathed deeply and held her fear, her surety guiding her. The darkness grew heavier, even though Shom followed her, as if the weight of nothing was growing even thicker. She took the torch from Shom and breathed into the flames, letting her senses expand, feeling the rush of magic flooding her veins. The fire grew brighter and wider, small flickering embers drifting up and out from the torch to enlarge the circle of light around them. The dark flinched back. Phila passed the place where she had once turned back, and that was when she heard the sound of something brushing against rock far below. She looked down. The limbs were long, thin, and there were dozens of them. They twisted at the air, bending, rising, as if holding on to darkness to haul themselves up. They were coming for the bridge, and moments later the first of them wrapped over the stone structure just 20 steps ahead of her. It was a pale, flexible appendage, and its color grew darker as it seemed to tighten around the stone. This was Dakur.
Behind, Per Rostolo said. Dakur is behind us as well.
Phila glanced back to see the small, silent Helene wielding her sword, crouched and ready to hack at the three limbs twisting and dancing on either side of the bridge.
Wait, Phila said. Don't hurt it.
Dakur can't be hurt, Per Rostolo scoffed.
Phila smiled at him, then closed her eyes. Daphine came to her, god of water and beasts, and Phila channeled the power and grace she felt from that god, feeling magic flow through and out of her mind and thoughts, veering down into the chasm and connecting her, briefly, with an intelligence so alien and profound that she staggered. If Shom had not caught her, Phila would have met eternity deep down with the thing that was Dakur. The touch was brief, but in that instant, Fila understood Dakur's confusion. There was no pleading, no negotiation, but rather an understanding in Fila that their momentary touching of minds might give her a chance. She opened her eyes, looked at her companions, and